welcome to the 19th episode of the Loose Threads podcast, a show about the intersection of fashion, technology, and commerce. Joining me today is Rachel Scheckman, the founder of Story, a company that has the point of view of a magazine that changes like a gallery and sells things like a store. Story is headquartered in a 2,000 square foot store in Chelsea, Manhattan, and runs themed installations that change every few months. These installations feature everything from experiences to products to talks and events, acting as a lab that merges the best of offline retail with the benefits of online media and commerce. Rachel has one of the more forward-looking and open-minded perspectives on physical retail that I've encountered, and it was great talking with her about how Story is carving its own path in the dynamic retail landscape. The next Story just opened this week in Chelsea, and you should definitely check it out if you're in town. Here's my talk with Rachel Scheckman. Tell me a bit kind of about your background, and then we'll kind of work our way up to
sure.
Story coming into existence.
I'm four generations of retail, so it's in my blood. There was kind of no escaping it. I got my formal start at the ripe old age of 12 years old. My mom took me into the city. I grew up a little over 2 hours outside the city in a town called West Hartford, Connecticut.
Okay.
And she brought me to the Jacob Javits Center because it was the New York gift show. And my mom was there to buy things for her store. And I was there to buy my bat mitzvah favors wholesale. And after walking with her and looking at all these amazing things, I stopped and I looked at her and I asked her that question that would ultimately be my career and change my life, which was, you can shop for a living? Fast forward, I went to college, I studied economics, I moved to New York shortly thereafter during Internet 1.0 days. I worked on a startup I never started, but I spent 8 months researching it and building it. It was called BoutiqueStyle.com, and the idea was an incubator meets a co-op for emerging brands and designers. And as we all know, timing is everything, and the universe conspired because my first investor meeting was in April of 2000, and that is when the market crashed with Internet 1.0 days. That experience really led to my first job working, you know, full-time for a luxury goods catalog to kind of get working for someone else out of my system. And then after 3 years working for Vive, which was the name of the luxury goods catalog, I left to take a six-month consulting job with Bliss Spas, and 6 months turned into 2 years. And then I got insane opportunities. I ended up doing partnership marketing for Toms when they went from like 25 people to 100. I ended up consulting with Gilt Group, Gap, Kraft, AOL, and like had this accidental consulting career for 10 years. I called myself the accidental consultant. It was called Cube Ventures. One of the things about me is there's like a five-year-old trapped inside me always saying like, but why, but why, but why? And so whether something works or doesn't work, I want to understand why. And so I was like, why are people hiring me? I don't have an MBA. I didn't work at McKinsey. I didn't work at Bain.
That's why.
Yeah, that's why. And I really stopped and looked at all these different clients and opportunities. And I thought to myself, what does a 50-person company have in common with a $50 billion company? And what they have in common is it's like walking into the United Nations with no translator. And marketing speaks Japanese, and merchandising speaks Spanish, and finance speaks Swahili, and no one is translating and integrating. And so the languages I became fluent in were marketing, merchandising, and business development. And so I treated that as one language. And when you're on the outside, you can often get things done much faster. So I kind of had one leg in the sandbox and one leg out. So after 10 years of exercising my Rachel theories on all my clients, I was driving with Blake Mikowski, who founded Tom's Shoes, and he said in June of 2011, enough of the someday shit, and my store opened that December.
How do we bridge the gap between this accidental career to kind of Story as it exists today?
So I think like when I look back at my consulting career, right, I was exercising and playing with different strategies, right? I really get excited about, you know, thinking of two partners or ideas or modalities and discipline that you can never imagine together. And the second they're together, you can't imagine them apart. So one example would be when I was at Gilt Group, I really treated merchandising as a customer acquisition tool, right? The sales and the consumer dollars that were a byproduct of it was a plus, but really the structure of my merchandise buys and partnerships were based on like a Google AdWords CPA framework, which is very non-traditional.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Rachel theories like that kind of congealed. And, you know, what really led to story was two observations. So story is based on this idea and this kind of principle that I call retail media. And so the two observations I had was in 2011 and kind of looking around, you know, we've had years and years and years of endless technological and digital innovation. And you have new business models that have then given way to new consumer behavior. So in retail, for example, you have crowdfunding, crowdsourcing, subscription retail. So those are new business models, and that's new consumer behavior. So if there's new business models and behavior in a digital world, and last I checked, we're the same people who live offline who live online, why the heck are we not reevaluating and changing both the business model and the consumer experience in a physical world? Now everyone's talking about that, but it definitely wasn't in vogue or keeping people up at night in 2011. And then the media side of my Rachel theory on retail media was really looking at advertising and where brands were accessing consumers. And there's outdoor advertising and radio and TV. But if you look at like Starbucks, 55 million people go through Starbucks every week. That to me is an audience. And so why aren't brands accessing consumers in these different habitats? And I'm not saying, oh, like put a sticker on a wall with a logo, right? Like there's other experiences that can be created. So basically those two observations on the retail and media side inform the story business model. And I borrowed money from a couple of friends. I didn't raise money. And so, you know, my goal for an audience of one, which was me, was to be profitable in a year. Because I thought, you know, no one has to agree or like the model, but you can't argue with numbers. And in retail, on average, you break even or are profitable in year three. So it's very unheard of. And we had expensive real estate. It was 2,000 square feet on 10th Avenue and 19th Street. I signed a 10-year lease. And so the way I describe how Story works is that it's a space that has the point of view of a magazine. We reinvent it entirely every 3 to 8 weeks like a gallery, and we sell things like a store.
And so I'm curious to kind of like set the stage in 2011. Where was kind of the fashion retail world at that time? Because I assume Gilt was like very hot at that moment, and nothing against them, for better or worse. But it was maybe like what, like the 2.0 version of kind of the internet taking that whole world by storm. How would you describe it or contextualize it?
Well, when we first launched and opened, we didn't call ourselves Story. So what happened was I signed the lease on October like 29th, 30th, 2011, and Ben Kaufman, who founded Mophie and Quirky, bet me a lot of money that I couldn't open by December 1st. And I was like, of course I'm going to be open for Christmas. And he's like, you have no running water, you have no electricity, you have no cement in your floors. Like, no, you're not. And I'm like, let's do this bet. I'm going to win. And then I thought about it and I'm like, crap, I don't have a trademark on our name. And like Story, it's kind of a popular name. And there was no way I was going to announce that we were called Story without a trademark. And I had no inventory. So I was thinking about it, and back to the, we're the same people who live offline, who live online. Back then, there was no Warby Parker stores. There was no Birchbox stores, no Bonobos, you know, guy shops, man shops, whatever they're called. There was none of that. So I thought, if tech companies get beta, why can't retailers get beta? So I called ourselves a startup store beta, and I only sold products from startups. So we had Birchbox, we had Bauble Bar jewelry, we had Art Space, we had Jour, which is a B2B marketplace for fashion. And so we brought to life all these digital brands in a physical world. So in terms of, you know, what the market was like then, I think it was a first. I mean, I did it to win a bet. Little did I know it would end up being a massive PR stunt, but that definitely wasn't the intention. I had never run a store in my life before. So I thought, I have to open in beta to figure out what I'm doing and learn from it, you know. And then a week later, the headline was, can a startup store reinvent retail? And I'm like, wait, no one's supposed to be watching. We're in beta. But physical beta is a little different than tech beta, because you can't kick someone out of the door once they walk in it. So that's a little bit about the state of the market and the landscape, and also how it relates to us.
I guess the genesis of this is some combination of the magazines you mentioned, of the commerce, and also the retail piece, right? This kind of like triangle. I feel like also around that time, or kind of in the last, I guess, like 5 years, there've been a lot of iterations of whether it's more as like a marketing piece, which is, you know, let's create a magazine for Net-a-Porter to then sell the commerce through. There's been a lot of history and kind of, I guess, refuge in the space. What do you think about kind of, I guess, like the prior or kind of concurrent iterations of that, and also maybe why some of those didn't stick, and then maybe why Story has lasted longer, given kind of the general bucket is the same, but obviously the details within are very different.
I think luck and timing definitely play into things in life. And for us, I'd probably say the biggest shock was the yearning and interest and need for physical community. So on the one hand, like, I roll my eyes when I say content, commerce, and community, because everyone talks about the three C's. But at the end of the day, when I look at our model, it is equal parts those three things, right? Like, I find it absurd that the retail industry still uses the metric of sales per square foot as the sole success metric, and also looking at revenue streams as such. So the way we look at it, and to your question about content, is if a magazine tells stories by writing articles and taking pictures, our version of editorial storytelling is merchandise that we feature around a certain subject matter, and then events we have that bring that to life. And then magazines have advertisers and we have sponsors. So you have two revenue streams on the commerce side, right? So sponsorship and product sales. On the content side, you have multiple types of content, right? Someone can experience merchandise as content. If someone walks out a store with a shopping bag, great, but that's not the sole objective. It's really about discovery. And so there are people who want to come in and discover something. There are people who want to come in and buy something. And there are people who just want to come to an event and engage. And that's really where the community piece comes in. So, you know, I always say we're this Venn diagram of kind of connecting big companies, consumers, and small companies and makers and small businesses. And we sit somewhere in between. And I think why story has resonated is because we communicate in multiple modalities, right? Sometimes it's auditory, sometimes it's visual, sometimes it's visceral. And so you're able to reach a wider range of people when you're communicating in different forms. And that's something we really aim to do. And we also customize it by subject matter. So the way we're going to talk about disruption is going to be very different than the way we're talking about Rugrats in the 90s is going to be very different than we talk about wellness with Cigna. I think the challenge with a lot of magazines or content is the content might change, but the framework is stale. And so you have the same sections of the magazine over and over and over. And in some cases, right, like Vanity Fair, people want to read the Prowse questionnaire. But that's more, I think, the exception than the rule. And so I think that the digital universe has changed consumer expectations and behavior so much that retailers aren't able to react as quickly as they need to respond to these changing patterns. And a lot of times they try and do it themselves. Like I said the other day, like you have all these retailers coming out with magazines or whatever. And like, look at all the magazines going out of business, right? Like it breaks my heart that Details magazine had to go away. But like, if you're at the sex men's store, buy Details magazine instead of building a whole editorial team, right? You're going to change the model. It's going to be different. I'm not saying it's the same thing, but like, if I was a retailer, I'd go start buying some magazines. But, you know, you would do it differently and in a contextually relevant way. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I also think it goes back to the translator bit of it, right? And you don't know what you don't know. And it's like, oh, everyone else says content's important, so I'm going to go hire someone and start a magazine or a blog. Or
yeah. Did you ever think of only existing as a store in the digital world, or was it always about having a physical space?
You still can't buy online from Story. It was only about a physical place. I mean, now the reason why we don't have e-commerce or mobile commerce is more of a byproduct of bandwidth and resources, because I think when we do it, we'll want to do it differently in the same way we did retail differently. But you know what? There were so many happy accidents with the store, and there's so much that we do in the store that people don't think of or know, right? Like a consumer walking in wouldn't leave Story and say, wow, that's a great living lab that they use for R&D, right? But that's why Target or Cigna might sponsor Story. Sponsorships is $500,000. And when we started, you know, it's gone up over the years. It didn't start at $500,000. But like, I wanted to be taken seriously, right? Because if I was there sitting in my CEO chair at a multi-billion dollar company, right, reading about this woman with her store that's changing, I'd be like, yeah, yeah. But like, $500,000 is like, you know, you're not buying a Super Bowl spot, but you can buy like a handful of print ads in many magazines or newspapers. And so like, I wanted legit dollars to say, hey, if we can pull this off on 10th Avenue and 19th Street, imagine what someone could do at scale. So that to me, like, is what's really interesting is that.
So the beta store was kind of version one. That was kind of the first existence of it.
Yeah, that was our soft opening.
So this is in 2011, right?
Yep. So that went until the beginning of January. And then we did this very short event over 4 days called Coffee Common. And then we officially launched and revealed our name Story on February 1st, 2012. And the first story we told was Love Story.
And that's back now, right?
It's back in terms of, you know, the iteration open right now is called Love Story, but you know, Love Story, you could tell that story a billion different ways. In the same way, you know, we'll repeat the name of a story like Love Story because it's important. And, you know, when we first did Love Story, the strategy behind it was it's going to be open during Valentine's Day. We're going to have things that are giftable. We're going to talk a lot about relationships and have Estelle Perel come and give a talk and all these other things. Whereas the Love Story right now is very, very different. And it's more about Story came out of my love for retail and doing things differently. And it's about celebrating our anniversary and our birthday and how it's evolved into a platform for other people's loves and passions. Because we've worked now with over 4,000 startups and small businesses and vendors. And so the editorial narrative is really not about dating in terms of the assortment, but how we've dated all these great brands and met all these great brands over the years. And also, I think it's hard to open up a magazine or watch a TV ad and not see the word love pop out at you. So that also informs, like, we did this collaboration with the artist Curtis Kulig, who spray paints Love Me all over the city. And we did this poster with the folks on Lin-Manuel Miranda's team blessing it. And we had Curtis do Love is Love is Love poster to benefit the ACLU. So it's a much broader message of love. And then sometimes we'll tell a story on a subject matter, but we'll call it different things. So we've done 3 different wellness stories, but we only called it wellness once. The next time we called it well-being story. The next time we called it feel-good story. So it really just is about that gut feeling, looking who our sponsors are, if there are sponsors, and what's the best way to bring that narrative to life. So in terms of what I mentioned earlier about the framework, maybe we need to call it something or have the framework change to get the message across.
And so what's like the genesis of getting basically a story from zero to existence? Like, what does that take? How long does it take? What's that process like?
It varies. You know, I've always called my life chaotic continuity. When I've spoken at business schools, I just see like professors wince when I talk because they're like, well, what's your business plan and what's your model and your strategy and your timing? And I was like, I don't know. But
it exists.
It exists. We've created a story soup to nuts in 3 weeks from scratch. There's others we've planned out 6 months in advance. And so a lot of it's really just been informed by sponsorship and, you know, knock on wood, out of doing, you know, 33 stories, about 90% of them are sponsored. Sometimes we like doing ones on our own because there's a certain subject matter or theme or something we want to explore. But all of our sponsorship's been inbound with the exception of one brand in 5 years. So we've been insanely fortunate in terms of the flow of interest. And then the fact that it's just always fell into place timing-wise. So it's really informed by that.
I'm curious to talk a bit about, I guess, first, how did sponsorships come into existence as a part of this, right? Because most retail stores have zero sponsorship activity whatsoever.
Well, it was part of the model from the sponsorship right. was a part of the model from the beginning.
Right.
And it just went back to like my Rachel theory, right? Is how can you create value and use retail, you know, as a media channel? So, you know, the first one was sponsored by Nerve.com, which was a dating site. After that was Benjamin Moore sponsoring Color Story. So, you know, when we work with a sponsor, we ask ourselves 3 questions. Are we going to have fun working with them? Do they add authority and authenticity to the category in which their brand exists? And then the third bucket is, can we create a compelling experience for men, women, and kids between 5 and 95? So if the answer is yes to... Very narrow, very narrow. So if the answer is yes to all 3 of those questions, then we'll work with a partner, right? And I always say, like, Benjamin Moore knows more about color than I'll ever know, right? So, like, they become part of the story and they give it that authority and authenticity. And we just integrate it in a way that's relevant. The first kind of big, like, Fortune 50 company to get behind story was in October of 2012, and it was GE.
Tell us a bit more kind of about what that was, because it's super interesting to have these very big companies almost focus on such a little space, right? Or there's like asymmetric interest almost, but it's super cool.
Well, there's kind of two answers to that. So one, what GE was interested in was creating a consumer experience where people of all ages could engage with machinery and technology that's used to manufacture what they make, right? So it could be anything from, you know, jet engines to medical devices. So 75% of the store was pure experience-based activations. So we had 8 MakerBot 3D printers. We had a laser cutter where you can make your own Metro card holder and sunglasses. There was an injection molding machine. We programmed it with over 25 or 30 different workshops. And that was really where this idea of experience per square foot was born. So as much as the store is a living lab for our clients, it's also a classroom for my Rachel theories. So that's kind of the there and the why behind it. But to answer your question, kind of like, why would American Express and GE and HP write us these checks for one location on 10th Avenue and 19th Street? And it's because our value proposition isn't one that's based on sales or foot traffic. So there's 4 buckets. And so it's typically 1 to 2 out of the 4 buckets that are part of the deliverables. So frankly, it's not that dissimilar to a consulting contract, right? Because it's not like, you know, the one word I can't stand that anyone calls us. I think there's a lot of value in the world as it relates to pop-ups. And I think pop-ups are great. We're just not a pop-up. Like, right. We're always called Story. I signed a 10-year lease. We have a brand. Like, what we do is very different. And there's an SOW and very specific deliverables with it. So the obvious one's PR and marketing, right? So GE might be sponsoring something on 10th Avenue and 19th Street, but they then maybe get 30 million earned media impressions, 90% of which come out of the first week of an activation. So whether it's 1 week or 3 weeks or 10 weeks, PR for a launch is typically in that first week. And there you go. You know, I call that your IRL press release.
Yeah.
The second bucket is leveraging the store as a content creation studio. So again, back to being on the outside and kind of, you know, I always say we enable big companies to be nimble like startups. Is, you know, you have your consumer marketing budget, right? So that would check the box of your like consumer experience at Story. But then in another bucket, you have your digital content creation budget. So for example, when we worked with Procter & Gamble and they sponsored his Story and we had a hot towel shave station, that was a consumer experience where they wanted people to demo and experience the Braun CoolTech razor or the Gillette Pro Glide or whatever it was called. But then at the same time, right, they have different video content they need to create. So instead of booking a studio or going to, you know, Joe Smith's random barbershop, they A, did a media buy against that where, you know, we created sponsor content that then went across like Cool Hunting and different digital platforms. And then B, they have spokespeople, right? At the time, it was Justin Tuck from the New York Giants, who's since retired, but Justin was a spokesperson for Gillette, right? He has to contractually create X amount of content. So again, they're going to either send them to a hotel room or to a studio or to another barbershop. So now you're leveraging the store as a studio. So it has nothing to do with whether it's on 10th Avenue or 19th Street. We did the same thing actually with Disrupt Story with Mr. Robot, where, you know, I mean, they got gajillion millions of impressions when we had, you know, Rami Malek and Christian Slater and the cast at Story. And then we streamed it live. The third bucket is a living lab. So when Cigna sponsored us, it was really for R&D, for qualitative insights to inform a very specific deliverable. And then the fourth one that's very specific is partnership product development. So when we worked with Viacom and specifically Nickelodeon, we created 100 exclusive products in 3 months with bigger brands like Keds and Smashbox, and then lots of cool independent niche brands. And kind of looked at merchandise as a content tool and put together a partnership with Neiman Marcus online.
I've been thinking a lot about this trend, and I feel like you see it with brands like Zara, for example, where you have, I guess it's like a framework almost in a space, and mm-hmm. you can put almost anything through that, and it's still a story, and it's still whatever else gets put right. in it, which is interesting. Is there something interesting there about just like defining the brand or lack thereof? Like, it's not like, you know, you were like, I'm going to open a retail store for 18 to 29 year old right. women who like pink and guys who like jeans or like.
Yeah. So there's 2 different buckets to the answer. So back to our magazine world analogy, there's people who subscribe to magazines, right? They get it every month because they love Vogue or they love Sports Illustrated. And then there's people who buy it off the newsstand, right? So someone reads Vogue because they like Anna Wintour's point of view, and then Serena Williams on the cover of Vogue 1 month, and someone buys it off the newsstand because they're a diehard Serena Williams fan. So that's like Story. There are people who like our point of view, and like the events and the types of products that we curate and source. And so they'll come to every story because they like our point of view. I mean, there's certain people who like fly in for every story and plan it, which is kind of cool. And then there's other people who might discover us because Taryn Toomey is doing a class during Feel Good Story on health and wellness. And they're really into that story because they're really into health and wellness. And, you know, the next story might be Have Fun Story about emojis, and that might not be their jam. Or there's the person who comes via Taryn Toomey's class on health and wellness and then like is really into what we do and then becomes part of our subscriber base. So discovery comes a lot in the form of the partnerships and the events that we do. And then I think, you know, when I talk about our audience being men, women, and kids between 5 and 95, you know, it sounds cheeky and funny, but I'm really serious about it because, of course, there's very specific demographics, right? Gillette wants to target the 26 to 38-year-old man, right? But at the end of the day, time is the ultimate luxury and the most scarce resource now more than ever. So if my target is that, like, 28 to 39-year-old guy, and I have a hot towel shave station in story, and the goal is for him to sit down and experience that, and he's spending the afternoon with his 6-year-old daughter, I better have something in the store that keeps that 6-year-old daughter interested so that her dad feels okay sitting down in the chair to experience that.
It's built for families in a way.
Yeah, I mean, some more than others, for sure. Obviously, her story had more in there for women than not, but we also made sure that there was food and design objects and books and other things that would appeal to different audiences as well.
So you mentioned before, if I understood correctly, that there's a big emphasis on discovery as kind of the core of it. How did you decide like that was where you wanted to focus? Because I feel like you could have other experiences that are more built for just having people buy lots of stuff, or like somewhere along like the customer journey, so to speak. Like, how did you pick the discovery piece as a focus?
You know, I have to tell you, I can't even say it was conscious. It wasn't. It's like hardwired in me. I mean, my dad recently told me a story that he bumped into a babysitter who I guess babysat me when I was 6, and she had no idea what I was doing now. And she told my dad this story that whenever we would go into stores, whenever we would leave, I'd be like, come here, come here, come here. I want to show you something. And I guess the babysitter would say to me, Rachel, we already bought what we needed. And I'd say, no, we don't need to buy anything. I just found something really cool I want to show you.
That's literally a story.
And so like, it's in my DNA. Yeah. So I couldn't tell you it was conscious.
So I guess given there's not a primary emphasis on just pushing goods and selling and having people walk out of the door, how do you kind of think of that kind of piece? Because you are selling product a lot of the time, or sponsors. So like, how does that kind of fit into the discovery heavy equation?
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, we are a store and we sell a ton of product. You know, holiday time, we're more like a store than any other time of the year. And it's our big annual gift guide, Home for the Holidays issue. And for our holiday installation, we have 2,000 SKUs. And so if you looked at the sales per square foot of that alone, separate from sponsorship, it's up there with national averages, like slots 3 and 4. So like, people buy.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that like, our staff and our training isn't like, you know, we have daily sales goals and we have incentives and all of that stuff because we want people to buy. But we have 2 revenue streams, so it enables us and gives us the freedom and flexibility to take a story-driven approach to it. But also, we have a dual value proposition, right? Because you have, back to when I was saying, we work with big companies, small companies, and consumers in the middle. We work with all of our vendors on consignment. And now about 12 to 15% of the people who walk through Story are B2B. So it's retail executives, it's buyers from retail stores, it's media companies. So we're this like living offline discovery platform. So now if you're a brand and you're in Story, yeah, you're going to sell stuff. But if a buyer from Macy's or Saks finds your product and places an order, now we're a trade show. And so the way we think about it in terms of both the visual experience with signage or the auditory narrative with the storytellers that work in the store, that's what we call our sales staff, storytellers, is as much about informing the consumer as it is being a marketing channel for small businesses. That also is the segue into my favorite thing that we do is pitch night, where we invite other retailers and media companies to come sit alongside me, and then small businesses and makers and designers can come and pitch.
How did you end up picking 10th and 19th as the location?
Well, the short answer is I live 4 blocks away. Okay. But the real answer is I wanted a neighborhood that mirrored what I hoped the model would be and that stood out a little bit. So there was no stores north of 16th Street on 10th Avenue when we opened, other than some bookstores and restaurants, but like no clothing stores, no fashion, no nothing. And I moved into the neighborhood before the High Line. And so I've seen the impact and influx of foot traffic because of the High Line. So I took a bet and a risk saying, I think that this is going to be big and it makes sense for all the right reasons. And if we were in the middle of Soho, we're just another store. And I'm not saying we're anything more than just another store, but we can control our narrative more if we're not trying to stand out in like a crowded mosh pit of retail stores.
So I'm curious to kind of talk a bit about how you approach, I guess, like the aesthetics and kind of the merchandise on the inside of it. Because it's not just a single experience, right? There are a lot of kind of experiences within stories itself. Like how did that kind of come about and kind of how does that all change in and out of each story?
Yeah, so we have a great merchandising team. And so for each story, we just kind of sit in a room and kind of once we're clear on what the point of view is and how we're telling a story, the merchandising team will then go off and research brands. And it's almost like an editorial meeting where people are pitching stories. They're now pitching products. And on the creative side, you know, we'll work with the store design team and graphic designer to say, okay, now what's the art direction and what's the framework? And we need to, you know, in the example of our Feel Good story, which was about health and wellness, and the products we were selling there required a lot of demos. So there were heart rate monitors, there was an interactive jump rope, there was like this Muse headband that you could meditate with, right? So there's certain requirements for certain stories from a space allocation or technology. So I kind of, I guess, serve the role as editor-in-chief who kind of becomes this filter and synthesizer, kind of saying, okay, this creative framework for store design and graphics and merchandise comes together and put it in kind of this package that manifests into what you experience when you walk in the door.
And so right now, the story on 10th and 19th is the single location where everything happens. How do you kind of approach scale, if at all? Like, is it interesting to have more? Is the plan to always have one? How do you think about that?
It's definitely a popular question these days. The truth of the matter is, for years, I didn't think about it. I think I was just so busy running a company. I was kind of like, you know, the scene in Forrest Gump where he's running and he doesn't know where he's running. So that was kind of me for a while because my goal was to be profitable in a year and we did that. It wasn't to have 50 stores or whatever. And I think if the store is a classroom for my Rachel theories, and a couple of years ago we stumbled on this idea of being a content creation studio, you know, even though people don't see it, right, one could argue we have scaled because now there's four deliverables for our partners as opposed to the original one of PR and marketing, right? But the R&D part or the content creation that has scale, it's just scale in a different way. So I do see that we've scaled. We've just scaled in our capabilities and we've scaled in our services and platforms. But I think in terms of what's next, it'd be fun to have story in other cities, but it would be fun to manifest it in different ways. You know, pitch night is something that's really important to me, so I want to focus on that more. And I think any scale that we do, we would probably do with an operational partner because I'm a big believer in let scale to your strengths. And my strength is kind of developing strategies and business models in kind of birthing them and then having someone else, you know, raise them and maintain them.
Gotcha. Do you own the whole thing?
Mm-hmm.
So we're in this ecosystem of there's just like endless venture money flying everywhere, which is great for some people. I feel like I've become personally interested in the opposite of that, which is basically people that own and control their thing to the fullest extent and can kind of do what they want with that. What's that like? Because maybe 5 years ago, there wasn't much money, but there's just money everywhere in the space right now. What's it like kind of having full control, but also I assume maybe not, you know, millions to throw places kind of recklessly for better or worse?
Yeah. I mean, I think I use dating analogies to talk about business. I've never used this one, but as you're talking, it kind of popped into my head, right? Like some people who are married wonder what it's like to be single and people who are single wonder what it's like to be married. And for me, there's, especially in the early days, you know, really important moments where I wouldn't have probably been able to do what I did if I had a lot of investors. But, you know, on the flip side, it really also depends. It's a personal thing, right? Who are those investors and those people? for me, it's a really personal thing and a psychological thing. Like, I did borrow money from a few friends, and I borrowed amounts of money that I knew that if I went to get a full-time job, I'd be able to pay them back within a certain period of time. So in my head, I have a very hard time understanding taking money with no guarantee of returning it. I have many dear friends and who are both investors and some who have raised hundreds of millions of dollars. And, you know, I think it's a very personal decision and it depends on your industry and your psychology and everything. I mean, let's be frank here. In 2011, if I went to go pitch Story, I'd probably get like a one-way ticket to an insane asylum because no one would throw money behind that. But, you know, on the flip side, there's other times when it's lonely because I have friends and advisors, but there's no one with like skin in the game who's staying up at night like I am trying to figure out solutions to certain challenges. So like that gets back to your grass is always greener because like, you know, it would be nice to have a certain reserve of cash for talent and for other things.
So I guess given you kind of made the bet on Chelsea kind of pre-Highline, I guess from like the tenant landlord side, has stuff changed?
I mean, there's some retail vacancies and those are primarily from new construction for apartments. So those apartment buildings are getting filled very fast. You know, there's a lot of new development going up, especially as you get closer to Hudson Yards. But there are new buildings with retail real estate that doesn't really affect me. But the more neighbors and people moving here from a community perspective, the better. There's people who literally come in the store every single day with their dog because we give out dog treats. So it's part of the walk. And the Highline foot traffic, I think, is now over 7 million.
Wow.
Might want to check that stat. But we're one of the only uninterrupted parts of the Highline. So you can get off the Highline on 18th and on 20th right. Street, and we're on 19th and 10th. And you can see it from the Highline. But like our holiday store traffic numbers were up, I think, like 22% over last year. So we haven't seen any issue in that regard.
What phase was the Highline at when you signed your lease?
It was already up.
Okay.
I just had moved into the neighborhood before the Highline.
So you had an inkling of what was going to happen, but...
Yeah, so one of my Rachel theories is I think you can predict emerging real estate markets by food trucks and panhandlers. Someone's not going to be standing on a street asking for money if there's not enough foot traffic to make money. Someone's not going to be parking, you know, a Mr. Softy ice cream truck unless there's enough foot traffic to sell ice cream cones. And so to me, in this neighborhood that had two restaurants, now there's CVS and now there's this and now there's that. And just seeing the insane amount of development on the residential side and then, you know, the responsive and receptiveness to the Highline combined with some of the other observations. And also, I mean, I guess in some regards, ignorance is bliss. I kind of didn't know better. I just went with my gut and I ended up getting lucky.
What have been, I guess, like a few of your favorite stories and then brands also, and those can be different.
I always love Home for the Holidays. It's our annual issue and we call it Home for the Holidays because we turn the store into a house. And it's the idea of taking an online gift guide offline and using a house as a framework to guide you through that. And so you can buy something for $3 or you can buy something for $500. And each room of the house is a different gift recipient. So the living room one year might be gifts for her, whereas the kitchen one year might be something for everyone and the playroom might be gifts for kids. But then the design of the house changes. So when Target sponsored it one year, it was like a mountain retreat. Whereas when American Express sponsored it, it was a modern loft. So that one I love because the merchant in me gets to go wild, right? Mm-hmm. Like last year, I think was the most amount of SKUs we ever had, which was over 2000 SKUs. Wow. So I get to shop like crazy. There's different things I love about each story, but I think my favorite would be Disrupt Story that we did with USA for their show, Mr. Robot. And it's my favorite because it was the most challenging for me personally and professionally to really say, how do you take a show that A, isn't really like ubiquitous, right? Like a lot more people watch This Is Us than they watch Mr. Robot, right? Because it's a much wider subject matter. And it has a very specific audience and narrative. And back to our story, it has to be relevant to men, women, and kids between 5 and 95. It was a challenge. And then we also brought in The Verge and Circuit Breaker as editorial mm-hmm. partners. So then we had to integrate them. So then you had like them as an editorial partner. And then you had to delineate in the user experience. You had to A, introduce someone who has no idea what Mr. Robot is and give them a sense of what Mr. Robot is and get them to care. B, you had to make it interesting enough for existing Mr. Robot fans and fanatics. And C, On top of all of that, we had to create our own point of view as story so that we weren't experienced just as a branded activation. So it was quite a challenge, and I was really, really proud with how it came out.
You alluded a few times to pitch night as one of your favorite parts of this. Elaborate on why and kind of what piece that fulfills or has kind of brought to the story experience.
Sure. You know, pitch night intellectually is interesting to me because I think, you know, if you really think about what makes Kickstarter and Etsy relevant and successful in a digital world, one would argue it's the combination of access and discovery. And back to, you know, this reoccurring theme or thesis in my brain of if we're the same people who live offline, who live online, what are physical expressions of those behaviors? So I think pitch night is a successful manifestation of access and discovery. And I think on a personal note, second to having an amazing family, I'm most grateful for the people I've met in my life, who I have relationships with. And I moved to New York, I didn't know a soul. And I think access can be more valuable than money. And someone shouldn't be penalized for it because they're an introvert or because they're a designer, not a marketer. So the idea that like someone could leave their apartment in Brooklyn or their home in Toronto or their condo in Minneapolis and come in for 3 minutes and they're sitting in front of Mindy Grossman, who's the chairman and CEO of the Home Shopping Network, or Jim Gold, who's the president of Neiman Marcus, or Adam Glassman from Oprah. They're there, right? There's no filter. There's nothing like tell your story. You have 3 minutes. You know, the value is really just access, right? And it's less about outcome. Mm-hmm. Now, oftentimes there are amazing outcomes, but I think for me, being able to kind of take this accidental recipe that we've been able to hone putting together, you know, small businesses and big businesses and consumers, you know, the fact that people fly in from across the country from Canada for this is pretty remarkable.
What's been the cheapest and then also most expensive lesson you've learned since you started?
The most expensive one would be just the existence of story. I mean, I signed a 10-year lease.
Yeah.
They made me put 9 months deposit down because I had never run a store before. And that was all the money I had. So I opened in the red.
How has the team kind of grown since the early days and kind of to where it is today?
Yeah. So my sister's our COO. You know, the way I describe building story, it's like I'm the owner of a sports team. And I have all these players on the field and no coaches on the bench because you can't hire coaches if you don't know what game you're playing. And since the model had never been done before, I'd never managed anyone, let alone run a store or a service business. I mean, I guess I did run a service business as a consultant, but for me, it's like, are you playing field hockey or soccer, offense or defense? So that was kind of interesting. That's had its, you know, pluses and minuses for sure. And the store team has definitely evolved and, you know, there's people who've been there for over half the story lifetime. And we have a really amazing team that's an eclectic mix of different personalities and profiles that aren't necessarily all out of retail. And then our corporate team consists of copywriting, graphic design, store design, merchandising, and I think that's it.
What do you think brands, I guess, either from just a generic branding perspective or kind of in the fashion retail apparel space can kind of learn from something like story of kind of the amorphous, non-rigid nature of it?
Yeah. What's hard here is like, you know, I fully believe we haven't even seen the beginning of what's about to happen in retail. I keep on saying we're on the edge of retail Armageddon. And on the one hand, it's really unfortunate and sad because a lot of people are going to lose money and lose jobs and stability. On the flip side, it's a big period of reinvention, right? And there's more risk in not taking risks. So it's an exciting time in that regard. So I'll get to in a second what I think big companies can learn from story. However, there's one caveat that I've been super passionate about lately because, you know, I'm someone who's friends with a lot of the CEOs of these big stores. And there's a fundamental problem, which is I could sit here and wax poetic about the importance of community or change your store design so that it's less about sales per square foot and you have more activation opportunities for brands, or change compensation structures, which I think is important, and change training and all of this stuff. But there's this little thing called Wall Street. And so you have a problem where you have this, like, I don't know how old retail is, but let's pretend it's like this 200 plus year old industry. And circumstances are requiring the fundamentals of the entire model to change. And let's say that maybe at the bare minimum, to make all the changes that would be required to like really nail it for the next 200 years is like a 36-month U-turn. So you're asking an industry to change while the system that determines its value, Wall Street, remains unchanged because they're evaluating one's success based on comps. So if you're a CEO sitting in that chair, you're like, okay, well, if I make this change, it's going to affect my comps and then my stock's going to go down. And so I could sit here and wax poetic and say, it's really, really important to think about event programming and community because store traffic numbers are plummeting and there's no reason to walk in a store to buy anything. So, you know, the assortment doesn't just need to change, and how you structure merchandising teams so that the assortment does change and we get out of Excel and into merchant thinking. It's easy for me to say that, and it's really a bummer because there's handcuffs to some degree for a lot of these different companies.
And then I guess as a last question, you know, as you look, how many years are left on the lease? Five? Kind of the halfway point, basically, yeah. Right? Kind of how are you approaching the next 5 years in terms of new things? Is it more the same? How are you looking at the second half of basically whatever phase this is?
It's hard because more of the same at story is still something new because every story is different. But, you know, story will continue to change as it does in the store with different partners and stories. And I'll have more Rachel theories to exercise in my classroom. But I think there's, you know, different partnerships and opportunities for story to express itself at scale. It could be in a physical format in terms of more stores, but it could also be in a content format digitally. So I think right now we're kind of dating and flirting and being very non-committal to just seeing what's out there in terms of what our different strategic partnerships or opportunities to do more at scale. So I don't know what that will look like, but I have a feeling one of those will probably come to fruition at some point before the end of the year.
Sweet. Well, thanks for talking.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Loose Threads podcast. Join the newsletter at loosethreads.com and feel free to leave a review on iTunes. We always appreciate it. This episode was edited by George Drake Jr., and my thanks to him for his time on it. It was awesome talking with Rachel about the evolution of story over the years and how it's used the limits of 2,000 square feet to make a massive, far-reaching impact with brands and shoppers alike. Retail is not dead, it's just evolving, and examples like story are important proof that bringing new thinking to old industries is powerful and profitable, rather than sulking about the demise of how everything once was. The next story is now open in Chelsea, and it's definitely worth checking out if you're in New York, and even worth a trip if you're not. We have a great roster of upcoming guests, including Matt Scanlon of Nottam Cashmere, Giancarlo Paternoster of Giancarlo Studio Furniture, and Josh Udashkin of Raiden. Thanks for listening, and talk to you soon.